who was king from 1603 to 1625, the Puritans had not only become a religious force to be reckoned with, but also a political force. Because, see, James was an absolute king. You've heard of Stuart absolutism, have you not? Well, that was a particular type of absolutism. James believed in the divine right theory. Now, you see, the divine right theory is interesting because people today thought it was terribly wrong. Now, it was not terribly wrong. There were errors in it. But the basic premise was that the king rules by the grace of God, which is correct. But he took it too far. He held that because the king rules by the grace of God, the king can do no wrong, and therefore that anybody who opposes the king is guilty of sinning against God. That because the king rules for God, he speaks for God, and is not only a theory of divine right in there, but also the almost a theory of divine royal infallibility. He came close to setting up a royal infallibility, as over against the papal infallibility. Now, he also engaged in a program of taxation. I don't want to go into all the political details, but he levied taxes which were on the face of those taxes unconstitutional according to the unwritten British Constitution of that day. He was violating, shall we say, the prerogatives of Parliament, or forcing Parliament to do things that Parliament did not want to do. And yet, James combined a tremendous degree of stubbornness with a tremendous degree of tutorability. He, in some respects, was much like Henry VIII. He didn't indulge in the number of lies that Henry indulged in, but I mean, from the point of view of his concept of the government and a stubbornness, and also, I'd say, a real ability. James I was an interesting character, but he did try to force episcopacy upon Scotland. He inaugurated that policy. Now, by that time, Scotland had a large dose of Presbyterian government in the church, and it didn't grow. You see, the Stuarts were both kings of England and kings of Scotland, because James was the heir to the kingdom of Scotland. He became king of England, and his mother had been queen of Scotland, Mary, Queen of Scots. So when he became king of England, he wore two hats, so to speak, if we use the phrase today, and you're familiar with it in business and also. when he tried to enforce an Episcopalian polity and concept of church on the Scotch, he should have known better. Now, he died in 1625, and he was succeeded by Charles I, who had all of the concept of kingdom and of absolutism, which James had, but he lacked his common sense, he lacked his moral character, he lacked much else beside. That brings it to 1625. Now, this also brings another point. This brings us to the point of the Pilgrims and the Puritans. It's interesting that the first trading company charters were issued in this period. You will remember from your writing history, I sincerely hope, that in 1606, the Privy Council issued two charters. One to the Plymouth Company and the other to the London Company. And they were given tracts of land in this country. It's interesting, and it shows the sovereign working of God in a kingdom, and a king who said that Presbyterianism and monarchy agree with God and the devil. That was James I on Presbyterianism. Now, granted, in government, the Puritans were not, the group he was dealing with were not Presbyterians, but he was speaking of their general concept of political ideas and of their theology. And he said, they just don't agree with monarchy. And so God moved in mysterious ways, and he granted two charters, which became, of course, the first settlements. James the First in 16 said, now I'd remind you of something. This is American history. That the Virginia, or in 1606, the London Company was just as Puritan as was the Plymouth Company. Or later, the Plymouth Company went through a series of changes and ultimately became the New England Company, which was the company which actually received the grant which produced the founding of Massachusetts. But it was a Puritan-controlled company. But the London Company was so also. As a matter of fact, in 1609, the London Company was reorganized into the Virginia Company. And the Virginia Company was named in honor of the alleged good Queen Bess, the Virgin Queen, which may or may not be true. If you ever read Elizabeth in Essex, I heard that virginity would remain somewhat in doubt. But anyway, the Virginia Company was even more like the Plymouth Company. It was, in many respects, an independent sovereign state. With headquarters in London, but the company, it was a well-run company. But its secretary treasurer, who was the real power behind the company, was Sir Edwin Sands. He occupied the same post for the New England Company. So that originally the companies which settled America were Puritan companies, with Puritan stockholders, Puritan directors, with a Puritan purpose. Now, why did he do this? There was obvious pressure upon him to do it. But at the same time, I think he and the Privy Council acquiesced in this pressure because they seemed to think that the further away they got the Puritans from London, the better off everybody would be. Certainly James I would be. He wanted to get rid of them. And so he gave them two huge settlements in the New World. And the Charter of 1609 had a very curious clause. This is off the record. you don't have to stop that. The Charter of 1609 said that the boundaries of the Virginia colony will run west and northwest from a point 150 miles north of Old Point Comfort and a point 150 miles south of Old Point Comfort. Now, that can be interpreted two ways. Let's say Old Point Comfort. You can run a point 150 miles north and you can run it west. And you can run a point south from Old Point Comfort and run it here, and we'll meet like that. And here's Old Point Comfort. But let me show you. This is what they did. Now, I can't do this board, but if you take that bar northward, you know where it ends? Ketchikan, Alaska. It took on the western half of Canada. It took in the southwestern part of Pennsylvania, all of West Virginia, Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, Michigan, Wisconsin, Minnesota, the Dakotas, Indiana, Kentucky. Well, it took in everything that Carolina didn't take, because in the Charter 1662, Carolina went like this, and San Francisco, San Diego, the northern part of Texas, and so on, all part of Northern Carolina, or the Carolina colony, which went down and took off. It didn't include Houston, but included the larger part of Texas. And it said the Great South Sea. Now, to be fair, they thought the Great South Sea was where the Mississippi is, but the Great South Sea proved to be the Pacific Ocean. So Virginia was the largest of the colonies, included about 3 million square miles. That's what happened. Now, why was that charter so vaguely worded? Nobody knows. Well, we know that was vaguely worded, and the Board of Governors of Virginia Company quickly seized upon it to expand their colony. It produced all sorts of problems in American history. That's where they got the Northwest Territory, which Virginia ceded after the War for Independence. That's where that's how they established the 49-40 northern boundary of the United States. And it was this treaty, or this thing, clause, which John Quincy Adams used to enforce our claim to Washington, Oregon, and in 1823 when he was Secretary of State.
John Quincy Adams, he was the succeeded by the Monroe, right?
He was the real author of Monroe Doctrine. He was one of the most able Secretary of State we've ever had. In fact, he was an extremely able man. John Quincy Adams. Of course, this is a dangerous statement I make, but I would say that from the point of view of sheer integrity and ability, he was probably equaled by only one other Secretary of State. And that was John Jay. And I would not want to draw a comparison between them to the injury of each one of them.
What about Atchison?
Pardon me?
What about Dean Atchison?
I hear static in this classroom. I don't know where it, I do know where it comes from. I'll let you answer that question yourself. Dean Atchison. The degenerate homo. He was. For a while I worked for Senator Will Smith of North Carolina when he was Secretary of State. When Charles I came in, he tried to extend and to enforce the policy of an Anglican government for the Church of Scotland. I don't want to go all the details, but this produced an uproar, the result of which was back in 1580, the Scottish people had signed the National League and Covenant. But in 1643, the Scottish people signed the Solemn League and Covenant, which is a tremendous document in Scottish history, in which they did not revolt against it, but they promised to defend their liberties. And they cut their veins and their wrists and withdrew the blood, and with a quill pen they signed the document with their own blood. This should have told Charles something. And in 1643, now the Puritans were in complete control of the English Parliament. Do you see that there? It's in the book there, I think. And they call for the meeting of the Westminster Assembly to draft a confession of faith and a plan of church government for England, Scotland, and Wales. At the same time, at this very same year, the great English Revolution began against Charles I. led at that time by Oliver Cromwell, the military. And as you may remember, Oliver Cromwell defeated Charles I, and he was imprisoned for 6 years. So that the parliament, they were known as the parliamentary forces, they were also known as the roundhead versus the royalists or the loyalists. you have a situation where the Westminster Assembly meeting in London, at the call of parliament, the king in prison deposed, and the Commonwealth had been established, or the Protector, excuse me, which was Cromwell said he was protecting England against the king. It was a semi-revolutionary government, but not revolutionary in theology. In fact, it was very, very conservative, and as a result they called the Westminster Assembly. Now, you have to have this political background, because by that time, the Puritans were in deadly opposition to all forms of political absolutism, and Charles I represented a more advanced form of absolutism than James did. James knew when to make some concessions, as he did when he met with the Puritans and had the what we call the King James edition of the Bible put out. He realized that they had a point, and he was willing to make a compromise at that point. It really wasn't so much of a compromise, because it was based upon the Bishop's Bible and the translations made in the time of Henry VIII, so that But he did have a conciliatory attitude at times. And he did give the charters to the Virginian, to the London and the Plymouth, and then to the Virginian and Plymouth companies. And of course, ultimately, Charles even granted a charter to the Massachusetts Bay Company, which founded, of course, Massachusetts Bay. Apparently, the same view in mind, to see how many Puritans he could get out of England, as well as to increase trade. Now, in 1643, then the Psalm Lincoln Covenant is signed. Parliament was called, obviously, first. And then Parliament invited the Scottish people to take part, or I should say to send delegates, which is the same thing, to take part in the Westminster Assembly. And this is where we are. Any question from you, Bill?
What is the difference between Pilgrims and Puritans?
Good question. At the time of the coming of James, there was a group in the church, allegedly in the Church of England, who were so discouraged and who were so despondent over the situation in the church that they left England and went to the Netherlands, where they were having religious freedom. However, they were Englishmen, and they did not like, they had their children brought up in Dutch culture. They didn't want to lose the English language. They didn't want to lose the English traditions, and they were English. And so they petitioned for a charter for a colony in New World. And they were Calvinistic, but they were more Congregationalist.
They are what? They are Puritans?
They were the Pilgrim Puritans. Essentially, there was not too much difference, except the fact let me put it to you this way. The Puritans who came to Massachusetts Bay wanted to separate from the King of England, but not from the Church of England. And the Pilgrims wanted to separate from the Church of England, but not from the King.
Which one, Puritan?
The Pilgrims. In other words, they were.
But the Pilgrims were not Anglican. They were not part of the Church of England.
They had been. Yeah, uh-huh. They were independent. They were part of the independent movement which broke out in the 15th. Well, really, I say at the time of Brownist movement, and it was sort of an offshoot from Thomas Cartwright at Cambridge. See, as I told you, I think last week, there were really three groups of Puritans. The Puritans who wanted to purify the Church of England. Then there were the Presbyterian Puritans who wanted to stay in England and to have a what we call an English Presbyterian Church. And then there were the Pilgrim Puritans, or shall we say the Congregationalist Puritans, who wanted to break away from the Church of England and come to the New World. But they didn't go to the New World first. The group that went to the Netherlands represented this group, but they didn't like it, and so they came back from the Netherlands and joined up with the Plymouth Company, which was formed by people who bought stock in from around Plymouth, southwestern England. And they took a grant. The funny thing is, they really thought they'd get the grant in the Virginia Company, but they ended up with the grant in New England.
So there are three kinds of Puritans.
The Puritan Puritans who wanted to purify the Church of England remained the Church of England. Secondly, what we might call the Presbyterian Puritans who wanted to separate from the Church of England, but who wanted a Presbyterian system of government in England, an English Presbyterian. Well, I call them the Congregational Puritans, and it was the Congregational Pilgrims who were the Pilgrims. Congregational Puritans were the Pilgrims who came to the Plymouth Colony in 1620. They were Calvinists. Am I clearing that now to you?
Pretty much so. Which group did the founders of the London Company and
They were essentially that of the Massachusetts Bay Company. They wanted to separate from the Kingdom of England, but why?
Oh, which group?
The group that was in the London at which company, which became the Virginia Company in 1609. Under the Charter of 1609, Virginia became almost a self-governing republic. And so Edwin Sands, S-A-N-D-Y-S, was the leading spirit in that company. He was also a leading spirit in the Puritan group, which under Winthrop got the Massachusetts Bay Charter in 1620 and settled Massachusetts Bay with 1,000 people.
According to the family trees there, the Pilgrims, Puritans, and our PCA denomination church, is that the same root?
Yes, no. Well, yes and no. The PCA church was formed from not divergent groups, but generically speaking, the moving force in the PCA, well, let me put it this way, the moving force in the old PCOS were the Thornwell and Dabney people. And the Scotch-Irish and the pure Scotch. The Scotch-Irish started to come to this country in large numbers between 1770 and 1776. Ireland, Northern Ireland went through three tremendous famines, one in 1707, 1708, 1709, another in 1728 and 29, and then another one in the early 1770s. And each time they had that, large droves of them came over. At the same time, in 1743, they had an uprising in Scotland in which the Scottish people tried to recall Bonnie Prince Charlie, who was the descendant of James, well, in fact, he was the son of James II, who was the brother of Charles II. When Charles II was removed in 1685, James died. James II took over. I mean, Charles II died, and James II came in, and they removed him by the Bloodless Revolution of 1688 and 89. But his son...
Okay, now when they left England, they had a grant and a constitution given to them by the king, right?
That's right.
Okay, but so when they landed in Massachusetts, that sort of boarded their Virginia plans, didn't it, in some respect?
Well, actually, it didn't void them because the boundaries by the 1606 Charter. See, what to go into political, the Privy Council of London, which actually formed and granted the charter, they didn't know what a colony looked like. They had no idea what the New World looked like, and they had no idea the extent of size, and so they made some. They made some unbelievably stupid deals, like the 1609 deal in Virginia, but they had no idea that could be double used, and you could grant a 3 million square mile colony with a little headquarters down at Williamsburg. I mean, that was beyond their thinking.
You said Plymouth Puritans, they are Pilgrims Puritans, right?
They're the Pilgrims, yeah, the Pilgrim Puritans. Now the New England Puritans and the Virginia Company Puritans were those who they wanted to separate from the Church of England, but not well. They wanted to separate from the King, but not from the Church of England. let me show you a name in 1628. John Winthrop, the leader of this group, was able to get through Parliament. I might add, he was a Cambridge-trained lawyer, a brilliant fellow, and he got a very interesting charter granted to his company. And to this day, no one knows exactly how it happened, but all the colonial charters, without exception, which were granted to trading companies in the early days, there was a London Company, the Virginia Company, the New England Company, the Massachusetts Bay Corporation, and one or two others. They all had a clause in there requiring that the main office, or we'd say the headquarters, the main office of the company, would remain in London. The Massachusetts Bay Company charter had no such requirement. So that when John Winthrop and his Puritans came to Massachusetts Bay, they brought their charter with them. Now, there were still stockholders left in London, but there was no headquarters left in London. Boston became not only the capital of the colony, but the headquarters for the company. So that Massachusetts Bay was really a self-governing republic. And under the Charter of 1609 and the actions of 1612 and 15 in regard to Virginia, Virginia became virtually a self-governing republic. Alexander Bruce wrote a very interesting history of Virginia, calling it the first American republic, a fact which Massachusetts didn't like, but the Virginia development took place before Massachusetts Bay, which was 1628. When the charter was granted. So this Puritan upheaval in England had dramatic and very important ramifications for this country. And you see, people, this is part of your church history, part of American history. When people say, as some of my evangelical colleagues insist, that we do not have a Christian heritage, they simply do not know what they're talking about. Or turn that thing off. The Presbyterian came and settled in Eastern Carolina because the Anglican Church was not nearly as strong in Eastern Carolina as it was in Virginia. But the main thrust would be about from Raleigh and over to about Roane County, all the way down into Upper South Carolina, into what they call Chester, York counties, and Upper South Carolina, down about to Spartanburg. That was heavily Scotch Irish. Now, in the Eastern North Carolina, the pure Scotch came in the 1740s and 50s. So that Presbyterianism in North Carolina was. Well, we don't have any statistics, but it was probably more in number than were the Anglicans. The Scotch-Irish were the most diffuse ecclesiastical group. The Puritans were almost entirely confined to Massachusetts, Connecticut, and New Hampshire. Of course, later Vermont, and later Maine. The Pilgrims were swallowed up in Massachusetts Bay Company in 1649. The Plymouth Colony became a part of Massachusetts Bay.
Our Presbyterianism in USA, which group do we influence by most?
The Scotch-Irish, Scotch group. English Presbyterians, because they want to stay in England. I wouldn't say that none of them came, but I don't know of any significant numbers. They could have been, but I don't know them. The Presbyterians were the most diffuse. In 1787, they were the group which could have been the dominant church in this country. They were diffused. The Anglicans seldom went beyond the Tidewater areas. Anglicanism in Virginia was from Richmond down to Williamsburg. There were a few west there, but they didn't like going out on the frontiers. Anglicanism in Pennsylvania was largely confined to the safety of Philadelphia and surrounding it. Anglicanism in New Jersey in the towns. Anglicanism in New York State, mostly around New York City and on Long Island. Almost no Anglicanism in the New England states. There were very few Germans in New England states. The German Lutheran Church was largely confined to Pennsylvania, New Jersey, Upper Maryland, Western Maryland, and parts of North Carolina. The German Reformed Church, North Carolina, Mountainous Maryland, and Pennsylvania, and New Jersey. the Anglican Church in the Tidewater areas of all the colonies. Very strong in Virginia, fairly strong in North Carolina, very strong in Tidewater, South Carolina, strong in Annapolis in the eastern region of Maryland, very strong in Delaware, pretty strong in Pennsylvania, very strong in New Jersey, quite strong in the more settled areas of New York, in the Hudson River area and around New York City, and virtually non-existent north of that. From Connecticut to Georgia, the Presbyterians were could be found. They provided a great deal of the intellectual leadership and the theological leadership. The Baptists did not start to come in. Well, of course, they came in Rhode Island, but many of the colonies refused to allow the Baptists to penetrate them. Finally, they did make headway, and after the writing of the Philadelphia Confession, Calvinistic Baptists evangelized the South. They evangelized, well, not this area of Georgia at that time, no. That area, in the colonial period, Atlanta was in the wild and woolly sections, inhabited by Creeks and other Indian tribes. But say from from Augusta, Savannah, in that area, it was Oglethorpe was Presbyterian. Yeah, but this was a colony in which the British sent all their jailbirds, mostly the debtor to prison.
Are they still Presbyterian?
Oglethorpe? No, it's no longer Presbyterian school, but Oglethorpe was Presbyterian. Very fine man. With high social moral ideas.
Someone said that that at the time of Oglethorpe, that in order to get credit to be a debtor in England, you had to come from a substantial background.
That's true.
And that the modern idea of a jailbird wasn't what we think of when we think about a jailbird today. Certainly didn't apply to the jailbird.
No.
And the people that Oglethorpe brought to Georgia were people from a more substantial background than most people would even imagine.
Well, this is partly true. In the 18th century, if you were a prosperous merchant and had a bad year and went bankrupt, you're quite likely to end up in debtor's prison. If you were an English lord who had problems like that, you too could end up in debtor's prison unless you had a lot of pull. We was the average prostitute, the average gun puller didn't get over here. They were middle and upper class people for the whole. Now there were some lower class people here. Oglethorpe did not refuse to take them if they could make it. But Georgia did not have the single-minded religious convictions in its founding that the other colonies had. It was not founded in 1734, and under charter from George II, 1733.
You go up to Greensboro and Greensboro, Georgia, up the road a little piece, which is an old developed section of Georgia. When you go into the cemeteries, most of the people, the graves are from people from Virginia and North Carolina. Mm-hmm.
You see, the Scotch-Irish, Pennsylvania had a fairly good land grant system, but Maryland had one, but Virginia and the Carolinas were very much interested in having people come in. So they would grant 500, 600, 700 acres, what they call a headright. And if you came in from Pennsylvania to North Carolina, they would grant you 600 or 700 acres for yourself and 200 or 300 acres for all your kids. So if you had a family of one wife and one husband and five kids, you could come away with maybe 2,500 acres. and of course, when the Carolinas were so successful, that Georgia opened up, and Georgia became the home of the fur trade. Now there's a lot of fur trade in North Carolina, a lot of fur trade in Virginia and South Carolina, but unfortunately, In the 18th century, Georgia legislation was pretty lax, and the Georgia fur traders, being pretty much immune from any prosecution, were the guilty ones of of offering the Indians liquor, getting them drunk, and then they trade them, say, a musket that high, and for a beaver or bear pelts that high. They'd stack a musket up on end, and then the Indians would bring in the pelts to equal the height of the musket. Well, you get the idea. And then they'd sober up. They'd realize they'd been cheated. And so they'd go on the warpath. And on the contrary, South Carolina had a very strict Indian code. And they simply would not permit the fur traders to do that, nor to defraud the Indians. But when the Indians were thoroughly mad, they couldn't tell them to South Carolina and Georgia. And when they went to warpath, they caught as many and killed as many South Carolinians as they did Georgian. And of course, that aroused the ire of South Carolina, who promptly complained to the Privy Council and everybody else that they didn't want to be associated with Georgia, and there ought to be some way to shall we say, educate the Indians who was who. It caused a lot of trouble. South Carolina actually had an Indian commissioner whose job was to see to it that South Carolinians obeyed the law and therefore didn't deserve the wrath of the Indians, where Georgia was sort of lax that way. Be frank with you. Georgia, I shouldn't say this, but Georgia never developed a great colonial or early national leadership. On the whole, now they had some men who were more able than others. But the Georgia delegation, the Philadelphia Convention, was obviously below the national level, except for one man, and he was from Connecticut, Abraham Baldwin, who was the famous Baldwin family of Connecticut. He was a Puritan, and he did have some ability. But in his state, it was subject to fraud, the Yazoo land frauds, and a whole lot of things like that. Whereas South Carolina never had a known important case of fraud in the state government from 1787 till 1865, when the Yankees came in. It had an unbelievably clean record. But it had a steady stream of great people. Calhoun, a Scotch-Irish Presbyterian, Robert Y. Hayne, obviously a Scotch-Irish Presbyterian, and then, of course, the great French Huguenots who settled on the coast. They supplied a great deal of leadership.
What about General Beauregard? Do you think he was really a Christian fellow?
I don't know about him. He wasn't a state leader. He was governor of Louisiana after the war.
Well, wasn't he the general who fired the first shot over there?
Yeah, but they sent him in. He was a French. He was a Frenchman. He was not a South Carolinian.
Oh.
He was a Frenchman from Louisiana. He went back after the war to become governor of Louisiana. He had a very sorry record involved in craft and crime. But he was sort of a flashing, dapper Dan fellow. But they sent him to Charleston to take care of the situation. Now, I got off in American history, but the point is that the Westminster Assembly had a tremendous impact upon American history because when these Scotch-Irish and Scotch settlers came over here, along with the Massachusetts Bay people, they adopted the Westminster Confession of Faith. Now, let's go to Westminster Assembly. It actually met for 9 years, but its great work was done in a period of 6 years, from 1643 to 1649. In my opinion, and it's one I share with many others, the meeting of the Westminster Assembly was the most important event in the history of England during the 17th century, outweighing all other events. And in my opinion, backed by years of study, I would say that it was the most important event in the history of the church since the close of the Reformation period. This assembly stands foremost among the great Protestant assemblies to complete the work of the Reformation. In Switzerland, it was the greatest. In England, Ireland, and Scotland, it was the greatest. Now, the Synod of Dort of 1618-1819 was probably equal to it in learning and moral strength. But the work of Dort was largely confined to the 5 points of Calvinism and to the Netherlands. Now, the Church of England did send delegates to Dort, but it didn't have any real impact upon the Church of England, not as the Westminster Assembly did. And see, in the realm, shall we say, of Christian morality, Christian piety, Christian statesmanship, Christian knowledge, Christian theology, the Westminster Assembly stands head and shoulders above all other groups. I said, but that so far as learning is concerned and moral strength, possibly equated or equaled by the Synod of Dort.
According to the Westminster Assembly, mm-hmm. one of the president committee who signed, who did the sign on the Westminster Standard, mm-hmm. He did not attend the Westminster Assembly.
Nobody's allowed to sign it because he.
Yeah, but he signed it later on.
Yeah, he
agreed. What reason he didn't attend their meeting?
Tell you the truth, I don't know. But the Declaration of Independence was signed by people 5 years after it was agreed upon. Now, I'm not speaking about him, but I think in the case of the members of the Continental Congress, they wanted to see how the war went before they attached their names to a document which might cost them their heads.
What was his name, Daniel?
Pardon me?
What was his name?
He was the delegate from Pennsylvania. He was a general. And I'll think of his name in a minute. But he signed it in 1781. By that time, Cornwallis was on his last legs, and it was pretty sure that the English weren't going to win. Now, it was composed of English delegates and Scottish delegates. It wrote the Directory for the Public Worship of God throughout the three kingdoms of England, Scotland, and Ireland. It was a result, the calling of the assembly was a result of a petition sent to the Long Parliament, known as the Root and Branch. The Root and Branch sent to Parliament in 1640 called for a complete overhaul, as we would say then, of the Church of England. Quote, that the government and the theology of the Church of England be brought into harmony with the Word of God, and that prelacy and all remnants of Romanism be abolished within the realm. Now, I should say this was presented to a parliament which you may have heard of, known as a Long Parliament, elected in 1629 and meeting until when? 1640. It did a long job. I mean, 1639 is what I meant to say. And the Root and Branch called for a complete overhaul to remove all remnants of Romanism from the Church of England. It had a membership of 151. It had absolutely no interference from the Long Parliament. Once it was met, Parliament kept its hands off. And the result, of course, were the Westminster Standards. There were Episcopalians at present. Charles I had forbidden them to attend. And it would seem to me that they attended because Charles had told them not to. Now, have you heard of Archbishop Usher?
Yeah.
You know why?
James Usher.
He's the one who did the dating for the Old Testament that you find the Scofield reference Bible, 4004 B.C. USSHEL, a devout Christian. Archbishop Canterbury, a very, very fine man, a very fine man, a devout Christian. And he had a tremendous influence upon his work, even though he didn't do much to go. But he was behind the scenes. He was a devout Calvinist. The great majority of the people were Presbyterian. They weren't Presbyterian government. They were the Puritan, or the Presbyterian Puritans. And Thomas Cartwright, I mentioned him before, had been their leader. The English Christians were not opposed to the episcopacy, but per se, but while they accepted the solemn legal covenant in Scotland. Now, in September 1643, I want to make this very clear. Parliament bound the Westminster Assembly to preserve the doctrine, the worship, and discipline of the church, to bring it into conformity to Scripture. And that was the agenda. The Scottish were very insistent that it must bring about a Presbyterian system of government, a Presbyterian theology, and a Presbyterian discipline. I don't have time to read you the Psalm. It's a very long document, but it is a tremendous document. Now, who were they and what did they want? In 1643, a grand committee was appointed at the Westminster Assembly to work with Parliament. These were the men. Have you ever heard of Dr. Twiss? T-W-I-S-S-E. Dr. Gattaker, G-A-T-A-K-E-R. Dr. Guthrie, Dr. Reynolds, Dr. Palmer, and name you will remember, Andrew Melville. You don't remember those names? Well, these were the high Presbyterians who wanted a very stately Presbyterian government, but in no way shall we say Baptistic, in no way congregational, but nevertheless Presbyterian. They were the high Presbyterians.
It's the higher, not hyper.
Not hyper. no. I don't know. I would say that they probably would like a form of worship which James Kennedy has in the Coleridge Church. Well, a formal Presbyterian service with fine Calvinistic preaching. that would be their meat. William Twiss was one of the great leaders. he was a high Calvinist. I'm not going to give all the names because one of the names which are very, very important was Lightfoot. Remember Lightfoot's commentaries? Well, he was the descendant of Dr. John Lightfoot, who was one of the great men of the Assembly. It was composed of great men. I'm just sort of yanking men out of the blue.
How many people were there?
121. seven of whom were Scottish delegates. But have you heard of a man by the name Samuel Rutherford?
Yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Lex Rex.
There's an organization called the Lex Rex.
Yes. The Rutherford Institute, John Whitehead.
John Whitehead.
Is that the Lex Rex?
Yes. Another Scottish delegate was a very, very able man you heard of. I think Alexander Henderson.
Westminster Standard is infallible? No.
Pardon me?
That's not infallible.
Standard?
Standard.
They're not infallible. No. They are called the subordinate standards of the Presbyterian Church in America. Subordinate always to Scripture.
Some people believe that Westminster Standard are kind of infallible stuff.
No, we don't claim that. The other great guys, well, two others that were most known, Melville, Henderson, Dr. George Gillespie, he was a pastor of the St. Giles Church in Edinburgh, and he died as Sunday was closing. Then Samuel Rutherford, 1661. Do you know who he was? He was a professor of divinity at St. Andrews University. Mm-hmm. You remember when they were going to, when they were writing the Shorter Catechism, they wanted a definition of God. And they had discussed and discussed and discussed, and they negated all the proposals. And they turned to Dr. Rutherford and said, "Samuel lives in prayer." And he began, "O thou great God, who art unchangeable, invisible, and so on." She answered, "What is God? God is spirit, infinite, eternal, unchangeable. And he's being wisdom, knowledge, justice, good, and truth." That came out in the prayer, "O thou great God." And he went on. And I think it was Melville, but one day I said, "Stop, Andrew," or "Stop, Samuel. The Lord has answered our prayer." And they wrote it down while it was fresh in their minds. And that's how that great question was answered in the Shorter Catechism. Mm. These are great men.
Which one made the first, the Short Catechism or Large Catechism?
The larger catechism.
Larger and short.
The larger. See, the shorter was derived from the larger.
Yes, that's right. Yes.
For the memorization purposes, the large. Now, people have memorized large and large catechism, but it's a major task. And in our church, when I was a little boy, we memorized the Shorter Catechism.
We are teaching Short Catechism to our children.
Good. The longer catechism is excellent for instruction purposes on a deeper level, but it's a long course if you're going to really do it successfully. But these were great men. Samuel Rutherford was going to be tried by Charles II. You may remember that Charles II was restored to the throne in 1660, and Samuel Rutherford was the chief target. And it could have been if he'd been put to death, but but his last days were spent and he was dying. And his immortal words were,
"When he died?
In 1661, I have been called to account by a far higher court than that of the King Charles II. But he went with an unblemished record. He went with a clear conscience. He went with the sure knowledge of salvation. Now, what did this Sunday do? It wrote the Book of Common Order, which for us is a BCO also, but the Book of Church Order. And it used a Knox's Book of Discipline for the Church of Scotland as a background. It wrote the Confession of Faith, the Westminster Confession of Faith, which was not entirely new. It referred back to the Canons of Dort. It referred back to the Irish Articles of 1670. It referred back to the Gallic Confession. It referred back to the Geneva Confession of Calvin, which I mentioned either last time or the time before. I don't remember which time, but it's not important. Anyway, the assembly was a very well-trained assembly. Practically all its members were graduates of St. Andrews, Edinburgh, Aberdeen, or Cambridge. They were all devout Christians, even though some of them were Anglican, some of them were Presbyterian, some of them were what we call Congregationalists. Some of them were premillennials. Dr. Twist was a premillennialist. Not a dispensationalist, but a premillennialist of the old school.
At that time, most of the people have kind of a premillennium theory.
I debate the difference with you. Most of Puritans had a very high type of postmillennialism. Have I upset you?
Really? Postmillennial?
Oh, yeah.
Most of Reformed?
Oh, all Reformed, yeah. Who told you I'm mostly premillennial?
That's what I heard.
I don't get upset by those theories of order and speculation.
Well, I don't know what your position was, but eschatology must never wag the tail, even as eschatology is the tail which must never wag the theological dog. On the other hand, we must never break fellowship with those who may disagree on and with my particular form of speculation.
Yeah, but your eschatology permeates and shapes your whole theology.
All right. Now, it depends. If you mean all the ins and outs of dispensation, no. But if you mean the second coming of Christ in power and glory, mm-hmm. That's not speculation. No, that's what he means. Now, with the didactic portion of Scripture where Christ says, I will come again, or Peter says, he will come in power and glory, and he will judge the saints, and so on, and the world will be brought to an end, that, we don't know how it will be done. But that's didactic.
The great doctrines of the church and the principles of the church that we live our lives by have nothing to do with eschatology.
All right. Now, I see your point. I would say, if you allow the eschatological tag, the tail to wag the theological dog, it does.
To divisiveness, yes.
That's all right. Now, it leads you to modify your theology to fit your particular brand, shall we say, dispensationalism. If you're pre-trib, you have to have certain things. If you're mid-trib, you have to change this bit. If you're post-trib, you have to do quite a bit of changing. Or you see something like that. Or if you believe, as Methodists do, that the second coming consists in Christ coming to your heart. Now that does do it. That does affect. But if you believe historically, as I know you do, that Christ will come in power and glory to judge the quick and the dead at a time unknown to both of his office. That is a product of our basic theology. Rather than dictating our theology, it's the product of our theology. You see what I mean?
Yes, sir. But when Christ in the Bible tells us how to live our lives and what we should do in this world, it has no reference to the end time.
That is true. I see
it. We really are letting the tail wag the dog when we get tied up in eschatological.
I'm not arguing with you. And you're not shocking me either.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Finn, our church in Korea, you know that we are influenced by the American Reformed Presbyterian Church very much. But they have a premillennial point of view in eschatology. How did you explain that?
Okay.
About 80% of the Presbyterian Church pastors, when I met them, they have a premillennial.
No, I make a point. That doesn't break one little bit my fellowship with those pastors, but I know them. I don't know them personally. Secondly, that is not dispensationalism. See, there's a premillennialism which is not dispensational. There were a few of those in the Westminster Synod, and I can't trace their numbers down. In the early church, I think most people would agree that Irenaeus held that position. Well, it's not always clear, but I would say that he probably fit in that picture. Probably before him, Ignatius was one. Tertullian was one. But Tertullian's premillennialism pretty much led him some very peculiar ideas about getting up in the mountains and waiting for Christ to come there and that sort of thing. He was sort of like the Seventh-day Adventist in the 19th century with Miller and the so-called Millerites. So that he's not a good example. One time, sitting in a faculty meeting at Wheaton College, a good friend of mine said that we should have a premillennialism like that of Tertullian. I said, wait a minute, brother. I said, what mountain are you going to go up? And he was a married man with children. I said, are you going to disown your wife and children? Because Tertullian was opposed to marriage, you see. And of course, mercifully, his group died out. I said, you better know Tertullian before you make his statements. Although it's not always been called the predominant view of the church, has been amillennialism because Augustine was, and the reformers were. Now the Anabaptists were premillennials.
That's right.
But they were dispensationalists with a vengeance. I haven't talked much about the Anabaptists. Depending upon which one you're talking about, Conrad Grebner was a Calvinist, but the Münsterites around Münster were well, let's say, put it this way. They believe that there are two great evils to the immediate coming of Christ, the Lutherans and the Catholics. And so Thomas Münzer at Münster proceeded to eliminate as many of those hindrances as he could. He conducted a great slaughter of the Roman Catholic and Lutherans, and they didn't particularly care for that. But he said the Scripture is not the final revelation of God. It is human experience that God speaks directly to you without regard to the Scriptures, and he may speak in contradiction to the Spirit, to the Scriptures. They believe in the community of lives. They believe in the community of goods. They were a kind of an ecclesiastical religious communism. Mm-hmm. And they believe in the premillennial coming of Christ, and that when he would come, that the Anabaptists would reign as communistic, or I should say, religious communistic society, in which there'd be no marriage. Which always raises a problem with all premillennialism. If Christ is going to reign for 1,000 years, and the ordinary human activities, for instance, marriage, will not be no more, I would say within 100 years there'll be no kingdom for him to reign over. He'd be in a situation which Tertullian got his group in. I don't mean blasphemous, but I mean now, the only other alternative is to say that in the millennial period, a sexual activity continues as it does now, as does all other activity. Now, if that is true, then is there not a question between the perfect reign of Christ and the maintenance, the continuance of the human situation? Granted, you could say that only sexual activity will take place within the marriage, which is fine, but not all sexual activity within the marriage bounds are necessarily Christian. You can have a form of husband-wife rape. Wife rape. You can have all sorts of things going on. So I have some very serious problems at that point. I have the same problem with the post-millennials. For the same reason. No, I don't think any millennial position that we have, as you have, well, amillennialism does not, in my opinion, answer all the issues which are involved in eschatology, because we see through a glass darkly, and when you're dealing with eschatology, you rightly point out, not one of those events has taken, well, I'm saying, not the so-called major events has taken place. Therefore, when you're talking about the atoning work of Christ, you're talking about definite facts of history. They've taken place. They are duly recorded. You're talking about the ascension. Sure, it's taken place. Talking about the virgin birth. Certainly it happened in history. Talking about the founding of the church and Pentecost. Yes, so on. Talking about the events of the Old Testament. Yes, they've happened. And in the order in which they're, you know, stated. And the place where they're stated, history. And while you may wrongly interpret history, when you do, you're wrongly interpreting history. When I was doing my work in the state of South Carolina, I ran across three treatises written by Charles Pinckney, who was the third member of the delegation of the Philadelphia Convention. He's now sometimes known as Young Charlie, sometimes by Thomas and C.C. Pinckney as Renegade Charlie, because he was the young upstart, but he was a brilliant fellow. And he wrote three letters to the citizens of Charleston when he was up in Philadelphia. I never forget, he said, "We may think wrongly upon right principles. We may think wrongly upon right principles, but we must not do so upon wrong ones. For how can the stream flow pure when the source of truth is polluted?" Now, how old he was when he wrote that? 25 years of age. 1783, even more than 1758. Now, Westminster Assembly. The Westminster Assembly took no stand on eschatology.
Yes. Sorry to name the books and works.
It produced the Westminster Confession of Faith, the Larger Catechism, the Shorter Catechism, the Book of Common Order, which is really a discussion of how you worship, and the Book of Discipline. Like Calvin, it placed a tremendous emphasis upon Orthodox evangelical Christianity and the confession of faith and the teaching thereof in the two catechisms. But unlike the modern evangelical church, it placed a great emphasis upon the proper type of worship. I think I went over that last week with you, did I not? Didn't I go over that? Yeah, the ecclesiastic ordinances. I thought we did. Calvin wrote them in 1541 for the Church of Geneva, for the singing of psalms and hymns, prayer, and the sermon. Now, the confession of faith, or I should say, the Westminster Confession did not demand that order, but it did suggest it, that we have an order like this, the opening invocation, the hymn of adoration, the confession of sin, the absolution of sin, not that the pastor grants it, but the pastor declares it. Another hymn, the sermon, the closing hymn of penitence and so on, and then the benediction. And the PCA Book of Church pretty much reproduces that general order. It allows liberty. We do not have a strict, staid, formal, always required liturgy. You can, of course, you vary the hymns. You can vary the order of worship. It really sets forth the components of the order of worship rather than the order which that they should follow. It sets a high value on prayer. And personally, gentlemen, I like to open the service with the doxology. Praise God from whom all blessings come. Or if not that, holy, then I would, personally, when I've supplied, I open with the doxology, and the invocation, the hymn of adoration and praise, the confession, the Apostles' Creed, and then.
Who wrote the praising God whom all blessings flow?
Do you really want to know?
That I heard it sometime, but
the music was written by Louis Bourgeois. See. Whom Calvin brought? Didn't I tell you this before? To Geneva to be the choir master of the churches there. What he wanted was reform hymnology, reform hymn singing, using the psalms, and the words that you are thinking of were written by Thomas Kent. There's another version to. Oh, people that on earth do dwell, sing to the Lord with cheerful voice. His praise for Thomas. That was also written by. Now, it's based upon, it's known as Old 100 for a very good reason. He based it upon 100th Psalm. Now, who was Thomas Kemp? He was a Calvinistic Archbishop of Canterbury.
When was he Archbishop?
In the 17th century. I should have pointed out that the Westminster Confession also paid attention to the 39 articles. As a matter of fact, Article 13 in the Westminster Confession was lifted out of the 39 Articles Act with very few changes. But the article on Trinity was lifted out with no change. Now, I have then given you the five parts. To the Westminster Assembly. Not all was accepted by the Church of England, because when Cromwell came in, he was opposed to it. See,
what was the five parts?
The Confession of Faith, the two catechisms, the Book of Common Order, and the Book of Church Discipline. I should have pointed out the political background. In 1649, do you remember what happened? Cromwell purged Parliament of its Presbyterian members. It's known as Pride's Purge. A Colonel Pride actually carried that out. And Parliament became the vehicle of Cromwell. Cromwell became a dictator. He did. And Parliament became his vehicle. And he was very much opposed to Presbyterianism because it was a Republican form of government based upon divine law, the Lex Rex idea of Rutherford. And Cromwell ran the show. The result was he turned Parliament into his own vehicle, and therefore Parliament was no longer Presbyterian. It was more congregational and more radical type. But in 1648, in this country, the Massachusetts General Assembly adopted for the church in Massachusetts Bay the Westminster Confession of Faith. So that Massachusetts Puritanism, although it remained, it was congregational in government, adopted the Confession of Faith. The American Baptist movement later adopted the Philadelphia Confession of Faith, which was an adaptation of the Westminster Standard, except for the chapter on church government, and the chapter on baptism, and the chapter on relations of church and state. But in its great doctrinal affirmations, apart from them, it reflects very clearly the Westminster Confession of Faith. Now, I think I mentioned it, but it's very important to note that when the Baptist movement began its program of evangelization in the 18th century, it was carried out by those Baptists who were in the Baptist Association, which adopted the Westminster Confession of Faith. So the early Baptist movement in this country was a Calvinistic movement. Now you tell the average Baptist in Atlanta today, and he'd be horror stricken, because most of them are anti-Calvinist. But the movement which preserves that is the Reformed Baptist movement. I think you're familiar, or are you? The Reformed Baptist movement? The Banner of Truth, Ernie Reisinger.
Right. Yeah.
And a friend of mine whose name I can't mention because of his former background. But it's all over the country. I don't mean in masses, but no matter what state you're going, you will find that there are Reformed Baptists.
There are no Reformed Baptist churches in Atlanta to speak of.
I don't know.
I don't know of a single one.
I bet if you made inquiry, you'd find out.
Well, at least I know some people that are Reformed Baptists, and they tried to start a church up on Robert Road a couple of years ago, and they were dispensationalists.
Well, I don't know. I don't know any Reformed Baptists in my circles who are dispensationalists. Now, I'm not saying that, but they certainly know the real Reformed Baptist movement is led by the Reisingers.
Right.
And I wouldn't want to go up and call them dispensationalists. I don't want to invade their Christian charity to the breaking point.
This Reformation audio track is a production of Stillwater's Revival Books. SWRB makes thousands of classic Reformation resources available, free and for sale, in audio, video, and printed formats. Our many free resources, as well as our complete mail-order catalog, containing thousands of classic and contemporary Puritan and Reform books, tapes, and videos at great discounts, is on the web at www.swrb.com. We can also be reached by email at swrb@swrb.com. By phone at 780-450-3730, by fax at 780-468-1096, or by mail at 4710-37A Avenue, Edmonton, that's EDMONTON, Alberta, abbreviated capital A, capital B, Canada, T6L3T5. You may also request a free printed catalog. And remember that John Calvin, in defending the Reformation's regulative principle of worship, or what is sometimes called the scriptural law of worship, commenting on the words of God, "which I commanded them not, neither came into my heart," from his commentary on Jeremiah 7:31, writes, "God here cuts off from men every occasion for making evasions, since he condemns by this one phrase, "I have not commanded them whatever the Jews devised." There is then no other argument needed to condemn superstitions than that they are not commanded by God. For when men allow themselves to worship God according to their own fancies, and attend not to his commands, they pervert true religion. And if this principle is adopted by the papists, all those fictitious modes of worship in which they absurdly exercise themselves would fall to the ground. It is indeed a horrible thing for the papists to seek to discharge their duties towards God by performing their own superstitions. There is an immense number of them, as it is well known, and as it manifestly appears. Were they to admit this principle, that we cannot rightly worship God except by obeying his word, they would be delivered from their deep abyss of error. The prophet's words, then, are very important, when he says that God had commanded no such thing, and that it never came to his mind, as though he had said that men assume too much wisdom when they devise what he never required, nay, what he never knew.